Welcome to the Relevance Report, where we explore the relevant stories that are shaping our world today. I'm Garrett Krasinowski, your host this week. On today's show, we talk about Jana Pruden's guest appearance at McEwen University, the changes in Canada's largest penitentiary, the anxieties in childcare for parents and children, and health and safety within the transportation of oil and gas. This past month, a local McEwen University class was joined by guest speaker Jana Pruden. Jana is an award-winning writer for The Globe and Mail and the host of the podcast series In Her Defense. We sat down with McEwen student Sydney Jones to discuss how Jana's talk with the class went and what she learned about the production of In Her Defense. With many varieties of media available at the touch of a button, many creators have been leaning towards a future in podcasting. Jana Pruden, co-creator and host of the podcast In Her Defense, came to McEwen University to talk with students of BCSC 325, a course focused on radio news and documentaries. In Her Defense is based on the story of a woman named Helen who had served prison time for the murder of her husband, even though she was experiencing intimate partner violence at his hands. Sydney Jones was one of these students that attended her guest speaking session. She is here today to speak with us. Hi, Sydney. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. It was great having Jana in class talking to all of us.
So what was something you found interesting about Jana and her work on In Her Defense?
It was super interesting how Jana has experience in crime reporting and to learn how she found out about Helen's story. She learned about it the same way as everyone else, the news. It kind of goes to show that there is a story in a lot of places if you just know where to look.
First heard about In Her Defense in the news in the fall of 2020. And it was a woman from Camrose, Alberta, who was sentenced to 22 years in prison for killing her abusive husband. And like many people around the country, I was really shocked by this sentence, which was so out of line. I've been covering murder for a long time, and it is such a high sentence. It was a plea deal. So usually in a plea deal, you see a lower sentence. That's the whole point of a plea deal. And it received a lot of backlash at the time. And I knew that there was so little put on the record in court that it would be a great story to really dig into.
It's interesting to hear how she went beyond the headlines and did a deep dive into Helen's story. To that point, during Jana's talk, I know that there were quite a few sensitive topics discussed, especially about Helen's story. What part of Jana's talk do you think resonated with you the most?
There were so many things she touched on while talking about Helen, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly what resonated with me the most. I really did think hard about what she said about Helen and how the system treated her and failed her.
You never know if it is going to work out. And I went back to her a couple different times in that process. I truly believed this was a really important story, not just about Helen as an individual, though it is about her as an individual, but also because it looks at the way that our justice system and legal structures, policing structures, fail individuals and fail victims of domestic violence. So that was one of the things that I felt would be really important to reflect on if and when she was ready, was to tell her story in a way that it will hopefully help other people.
I'm interested in how Helen's story has impacted those who have experienced intimate partner violence similar to Helen. I know we touched on how Jana's talk in general resonated with you, but do you think Helen's story has raised awareness about intimate partner violence?
I cannot speak on behalf of victims of intimate partner violence or otherwise, but I do think she was courageous in speaking out about her situation. It really opened my eyes. There are so many different stories and so many ways to truly educate yourself on the topic. I know that Jana had mentioned that she had received many questions about Helen's story.
Here to me is, it's a decision you can make to tell your story, to share your story. And it's not easy by any means, but it is very empowering. And I literally get it's been out for months now. I get emails every single day from people saying, you know, thank you for telling this story. It really has helped people. And so many people write to me saying, this could be my life. This could be my family. Some people, I didn't know domestic violence was still a problem, which is amazing. But that's really good. That means we're like educating people and people are learning from it and feeling seen by it and maybe having their lives changed because of her courage in sharing it.
Thank you for bringing this important story to us today. We'll be sharing a link to Jana's podcast in the show notes for anyone who wants to listen. Sydney, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Prince Albert, Saskatchewan is home to the largest penitentiary in Canada. The city of Prince Albert was the third most violent crime city in Canada among communities with populations over 10,000. With such high violent crime, many of those offenders will end up in the Prince Albert Penitentiary. Brooklyn Listician talks with Murray and Michelle Ketsmerick to discuss the changes in the prison system at the Prince Albert Penitentiary.
If you find yourself driving near the North Saskatchewan River, you end up in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. Just a little further, you will come across a castle-like structure. The historic structure is the Prince Albert Federal Penitentiary. The Saskatchewan Penitentiary at Prince Albert began operations in 1911. The institution later constructed a large landmass for farmland in 1962. In 2009, the institution canceled their farming programs and left the institution minimal to no programs for inmates. After, with changes in education on mental health and community programs, the penitentiary changed to Stride for Rehabilitation. With changes comes problems. Brooklyn Lestrician explores the changes in Canada's largest federal penitentiary in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. Marie and Michelle Kitzmarek sit down to talk about their experiences working at the Prince Albert Penitentiary. For many living in Prince Albert, they know the story of how the city had the option of choosing whether to house the University of Saskatchewan or the Saskatchewan Federal Penitentiary. Jokes are made that living in the city, you either work at the penitentiary or you're in the penitentiary. The city of Prince Albert was the third most violent city in Canada among communities with populations over 10,000. With such high violent crime, many of those offenders will end up in the Prince Albert Penitentiary.
Prince Albert is actually one of the largest federal facilities in Canada. We have 500 plus bed medium facility. We have two maximum security units, which house almost 400 offenders. And then we have a minimum security facility, all within the same grounds, which houses now, I think, with the recent expansion, they're up to like 300 and some offenders. So it's really a big facility, all multi-level.
That was Marie Kitzmarek talking about the reality of the size of the institution. Marie talks about how the penitentiary had changed over the 27 years of working as a corrections officer.
Huge, huge changes from when I started. When we started, it was just locked right down, very minimal movement. There was the inmates, then there was the guards, and there wasn't much interaction in between. Very minimal managing of the offenders other than just incarcerating them. And by the time when I started, case management was starting to come into effect where they wanted to bring in way more parole officers, which is what they're called, and they would reduce their caseloads and become actively involved with encouraging them. They didn't want to just incarcerate them and throw them out on the streets because they realized that that wasn't working, right? So they started reducing the size of them, having them more involved, giving them more opportunities like personal development, ETAs to go out on the street and do different things. They started bringing in way more types of different programs that they could attend to help improve themselves. Of course, none of that is actually mandatory, but you would work with encouraging them, right? And it worked. Like, it really changed. And then even just the security of the institution, by the time I left, the prison was basically wide open. They would call work in the morning and people would go, and it was night and day. All of the cages that were armed in our medium security institution were removed, and it just totally changed. It was more of personal responsibility on them rather than us making sure that they can't go anywhere. No, it changed like completely.
Huge impact, and then having programs in there too. So they get to, the whole case management team is program officers, correctional officers, parole officers, the higher supervisors, the psychologists. So you have a whole team of people for each offender that are all, so we get to say what they're learning in programs and how they're making some changes and, you know, how they're thinking differently, and that will change their behavior. And they get to see our report saying what they're learning. So they get to say, well, you're learning cognitive skills right now or anger management, and you're out beating someone up in the yard. But, you know, it's just everybody, it's an integrative, you know, more whole ability to assist. And is it going to help them to change versus warehousing them, locking them up?
That was Michelle Kitzmarek, who spent 5 years as program officer at the Prince Albert Penitentiary. She talks about the benefits that these programs were to inmates, families, and the community. Over the years, the penitentiary saw many changes. However, problems from the outside world became problems in the institution. The opiate crisis.
There's always drugs within the prison systems. It gets brought in. We ended up having to put Narcan on all of our posts. All of the posts, all of the security units, the different areas, the squad office where the manager is, all had backup. We had Narcan everywhere, and everybody had to be trained on how to administer Narcan. then it was also the risk to ourselves and exposure when we're inside a cell searching.
By understanding the cause of addiction, Correctional Services of Canada has made mental health services top of their priority. Marie and Michelle finish our conversation talking about how they enjoyed working at the penitentiary. Marie explains that if you give respect, you will get respect. He explains that he always saw the inmates as people before criminals. Even though the penitentiary has seen its problems, the main focus will always be rehabilitation for a safer community. For the Relevance Report in Edmonton, this has been Brooklyn Lestrician.
In today's society, parents need to be working to provide for their families, making childcare more important than ever. One of the major issues when it comes to childcare is the anxiety of not only the children, but the parents as well. I sat down with workers from Bright Horizons Childcare to see how childcare centers help ease this anxiety-filled transition period.
The first day at a childcare center can be stressful for both the children and the parents. It is sometimes the first time they have been separated, and that can be difficult without proper support. Thankfully, childcare providers are trained and trusted to make these types of transitions as smooth as possible. They create a bond of trust with not only the children, but the parents as well. Here's how they do that.
I think the biggest thing that makes parents feel better about their children being at the center is just knowing that their kids are safe and cared for. And so seeing those relationships with the educators and their child just makes them feel so much better about it.
That was Kaylee Fawcett, a child development supervisor and administrative assistant at Bright Horizons Childcare. Kaylee also spoke about how they help ease the stress of the parents dropping their children off for the first time.
I think the stress and anxiety, a lot of it is more from our infant and toddler parents. A lot of them are going back to work for the first time since having their children, so the stress and anxiety is quite heightened. With our older ones, the drop-offs, the initial drop-offs and coming to the center for the first time is a lot easier. But for the parents who have that stress and anxiety, we do transition days for them. So a few days before they start, we let the parents come into the rooms with the kids. They'll stay for a few hours with their child, and then the next few transition days they'll spend less time with their child until the child eventually is just there on their own. And that helps the parents to know that they're familiar with the routines, they're getting to know the educators a lot better, they can see that their child is doing well, and then they typically feel quite a bit better after that.
I also spoke with Morgan Martins, an early learning childcare provider, on how they helped the children through the anxiety of being dropped off at a childcare center for the first time.
I just provide comfort to them in the best way that I know how, offering them like hugs or carrying them around the classroom or just offering them items that can help them feel better, like a soother or their blankets from home. Sometimes even just offering them some water or their teething ring can help them feel better.
Morgan also went on to state how each child's situation within childcare is different and unique.
I would say like it all really depends on the child. Like no, I can't say like a certain time frame just because I feel like every child is different, and some children adjust really well to a new environment, and some children it can vary. It can take quite a while or not a long time at all. A lot of children, it really depends on a lot of variables. Some children really thrive being around high energy and whatnot, and some children it just takes a longer time to adjust and be comfortable in their environment, which can be difficult when you're a young child going into an unknown environment.
Oh, please don't tip it! Don't tip it!
According to Energy Safety Canada, transportation accidents are the cause of 40% of occupational fatalities in Alberta and Saskatchewan. While these accidents can be caused by multiple factors, it is important to consider those who are actively trying to cut this statistic. Sydney Jones sat down with Sarah Storty to get an inside look into how health and safety is taken seriously in the transportation and oil and gas industry.
Health and safety is a key element to many careers involved in running a successful business. Included in general health and safety are rules and regulations that employers and employees must follow. Sarah Storty, the transportation manager at Bulldog Energy Group,
says that her job is very diverse and there are multiple areas of coverage when looking after her workers' safety in the workplace.
So I am in charge of compliance for safety regulations as well as transportation. So permits, hours of service, following all federal guidelines. My position is very unique. So it's kind of a weird liaison between operations and safety and maintenance because I wear a hat in all of the divisions. So I am the face that our new employees see when they first come in. I need to set them up with their training and their onboarding and make sure that they're set up for success so that when they go on the road, they're compliant. But also I need to be a mentor and kind of a reference for my fellow managers and my coworkers in the field so that we can make the best decisions for our company.
While Sarah works to aid the company in following the correct processes and procedures, it is important also to know who these safety accidents are reported to and how these reports fall under the guidelines that companies must follow.
So we are governed by Occupational Health and Safety and National Transportation Canada. So we have some very strict guidelines that we need to follow, as well as with dangerous goods, we have CanuTech reporting. So they make it very cut, clear, and dry for what needs to be reported and when. Where I find that the gray area with that is if it's an incident that's not at the severe level that it needs to be reported to OH&S, for example, but it still has the potential, so an SIF, a severe incident that could have caused a fatality. Those are new that are coming into the safety industry, and they really are opening managers and executives' eyes as to taking the investigation and determining an actual root cause very seriously.
New workplace accidents can happen every day, and there are several different risks involved in different workplaces. The solution to ever-evolving issues is, in fact, evolving the safety precautions themselves. Safety is always changing.
So I started my career in safety. I specialized in that right from the get-go when I was 18. And even since then to now, the industry has changed tenfold. Safety, I've always said it, it's a very new industry, and it's built on the things that we see has happened. So unfortunately, safety is driven around incidents, and with the more incidents and the serious ones that we have happening, we see the culture changing every day. And I think we are a long ways away from that change to stop.
Even when most of the world stopped for the pandemic, the evolution of these precautions and regulations continued. As Sarah said, safety doesn't stop.
COVID was really interesting seeing that come into the workplace. It kind of threw everyone for a loop. None of us knew how to navigate it, knew the correct policies and procedures that should have been implemented. And because the guidelines put out by the government were changing every day also, it was hard to kind of keep accurate with it. Because of my industry with oil and gas, we didn't stop. So we didn't see a shortage of work, but we saw the day-to-day changes. So site requirements change, additional testing. We saw the introduction of isolation and distancing and moving a lot away from paperwork and more into an electronic world, which isn't terrible because that change was coming anyways, but a lot of it was spearheaded from COVID.
With careers in the health and safety world continuing to spread, the need for people to lead in the industry grows. While the job may seem daunting for anyone up to the task, Sarah has some encouragement for those who are traveling the same career path as she was when she started growing her skills.
I love my industry. I started in the transportation industry and specialized in safety right from the get-go. I started in Fort Mac right when I was 18, like from high school, running in a male-dominated world, and it has been an adventure. The only thing really I would say is don't be shy. Put yourself in whatever field it is that you want to do, and you can definitely succeed and grow in that. And don't let those stigmatisms of male-dominated worlds shut you down.
Thanks for joining us for the Relevance Report. This week's episode was produced by Darby Crouch, Garrett Krasinowski, Sydney Jones, and Brooklyn Lestition. The show was edited by Sydney Jones. The show's supervising producer is Sheena Rossiter, additional studio supervision by Sasha Stanojevich. This podcast is produced as part of BCSE 325 Radio News and Documentaries course in the winter 2024 semester. The course is part of the Bachelor of Communication Studies program in the Department of Communication at McEwen University. The show was edited and produced out of the McEwen Media Production Studio. Our theme music is called Buzzing by Kaylee Lambert. Additional music was New Logo Intro by Brick Z Studios from Pixabay. Logo design for this podcast is by Sasha Stanojevich. And I'm Garrett Krasinowski, your host for this week's episode. This podcast was recorded on Treaty 6 territory, the traditional and ancestral territory of the Cree, Dene, Blackfoot, Saulteaux, and Nakota Sioux. We acknowledge that this territory is home to the Métis settlements and the Métis Nation of Alberta Regions 2, 3, and 4 within the historical Northwest Métis homeland. Don't forget to subscribe to the Relevance Report on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review and rating. It really helps people find the show. Please join us again next week when we report the relevant stories that are shaping our world.